Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Ann Danahy. Today, we're talking with three Penn State faculty members about academic freedom in and out of the classroom. Joining us are Michelle Rodino-Colicino, Interim President of the American Association of University Professors Penn State Chapter, Michael Barrowbay, Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of Literature, and Cynthia Young, Head of the Department of African American Studies. Thank you all for joining us. Michelle, you recently moderated a panel discussion on academic freedom. Why now? Did anything in particular prompt it?
Yes, well, actually, the AUP has actually received an uptick in reports of targeted harassment of faculty for research, for things that faculty teach in the classroom, and for things that faculty are saying outside of the classroom. And this has been having a chilling effect on academic freedom, and also, of course, has included threats to faculty members, sometimes including threats of physical violence.
The issue of academic freedom has come up recently around courses about race and society. One course at the University of Wisconsin is titled The Problem of Whiteness. Another at Yale is The Construction of Whiteness. Michael, legislators and others have weighed in on this. Do you think that's fair for legislators and others to insert themselves in the conversation?
Is it fair? It's uninformed is what it is. So I wanted first to bring up those examples, partly because, as Michelle says, this has been an uptick in assaults, verbal or other or threats to professors. On one hand, it's nothing new, but the volume is new. This is a Trump effect, pretty clearly. And it also is diagnostic that most of the attacks have been involved with courses concerning race. Gender and sexuality also, made the Middle East, but these days, mostly race. The course title I gave you, called The Problem of Whiteness, caused a bit of a stir. It was on the right-wing noise machines outrage list last year. It got some Wisconsin legislators threatening to defund the university. And if you go to the homepage of the course, if you go to the professor's course description, you'll see that what kicks it off is W.B. Du Bois' famous line from The Souls of Black Folk, "How does it feel to be a problem?" Followed by Richard Wright saying 40 years later, "There is no Negro problem in this country. What we have is a white supremacy problem." There's nothing wrong with that course. It is, for better and worse, as American as apple pie, and more white folks should be aware of that black critical tradition that says there is no Negro problem, as it used to be called. There is a white supremacy problem. And in fact, the course went quite well. My argument about all this is that what people don't understand about academic freedom is it's not the same thing as freedom of speech at all. It actually has to do with expertise. You have been trained in the study of a subject, which is why a professor's comments about this might matter more than a student's. Professor Young over here has been working on white nationalism lately. She's an expert in it. She gets to say what she's learned, and she is actually licensed to do so in a sort of professional way, and that's very different from general First Amendment speech.
If we're at a public university that receives a lot of state funding, though, isn't it fair for the legislator to take a look at something and say, you know what, I have some issues or I have some questions, I have a difference of opinion? Isn't that part of academia? And
to a point, yes, of course. I mean, this is a public university with a public mission. It's a land-grant university, and if in fact people were doing things that crossed a line, either in disciplinary terms or in political terms, that should be brought to people's attention. That doesn't mean that the taxpayers get to call the tune. It's not a democratic institution in that sense. If 90% of the people of Pennsylvania believe in astrology more than astronomy, we are not going to change our course offerings as a result. It is not democratic in that sense. So there's a real tension here, especially at public universities, between their democratic mission to educate and the kind of expertise that is required to make that happen.
We'll go over to a question for Cynthia. So as Michelle was saying, the AAUP has said faculty can be targeted for topics they cover them or how they do that. Do you see this as a problem at Penn State? Have you heard from faculty?
I definitely have heard from faculty. I would say it's probably been more low level in the sense that they get, you know, an anonymous note, or they get on their student teaching evaluations, they'll get, you know, comments that say, you know, this professor talked too much about, you know, white supremacy or talked too much about gender discrimination, et cetera. So you definitely see it in that way. And even though they're kind of low level, they actually do have a very large impact, because our student teaching evaluations are one of the things that determine whether we get tenure, whether we get promoted to full, whether we have successful reviews. So it does have an impact. And studies have shown that faculty of color and people who teach courses that talk about social justice issues, particularly race, tend to have lower teaching evaluations, because students often, especially in predominantly white institutions, don't like to be challenged.
Michael, you mentioned the legislators targeting, and you're saying it's targeting at the student level. Could this have a stifling effect on faculty and conversations? Will some faculty just say, you know what, I don't want to touch these topics because I don't want to stir the pot too much?
Sure. I mean, it's hard to prove a preemptive self-censoring like that, but we're pretty sure it happens, and people are watchful, shall we say. You've also got the phenomenon sometimes of students taping in class using phones. And so people are especially watchful for what they say.
I mean, I can give you a concrete example, too. I mean, in terms of the African American Studies Department, I think, you know, I am very lucky to have a very committed group of faculty, many of whom are untenured, right? So they are in situations where they will be evaluated for employment, who won't change what they do because they're committed to it. It's their research, it's their expertise, it's their, you know, kind of political and pedagogical commitment. Many of us have been doing this a long time in an environment that has been more or less hostile. It's particularly hostile now, but I don't think it's, you know, so unfamiliar to people. But in terms of a kind of concrete example, Professor Kianga Yamada-Taylor was just here. She's a Princeton University professor. Her PhD is from Northwestern. She was targeted by the right wing, and particularly Fox News, last summer. She was asked to give a commencement address at Hampshire College. She gave it at one point. During it, she called President Trump a white supremacist, among other things she was talking about. And she was targeted by Fox News. I believe that was Memorial Day weekend. So for 4 days in a row, they had stories about her in particular. Right. She received 48 emails that were hostile, that used racial epithets, that talked about the fact that she was a lesbian, that threatened to kill her. I mean, she actually did have to change her speaking engagement. She had to think about whether or not she was going to engage bodyguards. You know, she's a 2-year-old child and a spouse. So it has impacted her, not so much in terms of what she's saying. She's an outspoken person who writes for The Guardian and publishes, you know, has published 2 books. But for example, we said, you know, we would like to tape you when you come to campus. And she said no. Yeah. And I think one of the reasons was because she does not want things disseminated on the web that can then result in death threats from white supremacists.
Yeah. And I should say, too, that there's a real connection between academic freedom and seeking truth. One of the founding principles of the AUP was, in fact, to protect academic freedom. And if I could read from an early document written in 1940, on academic freedom, it states that academic freedom is essential to the common good. The common good depends upon the free search for truth and its free exposition. So if we have a situation where faculty are being targeted for what we teach, for what we research, that really limits our freedom, and in so doing, it limits our ability to search for the truth.
It goes back to your question also about the public university. It's part of a social contract. Right. We'll give professors academic freedom, and they'll search for the truth as best they understand it in their fields. And in exchange, eventually this will have something to do with the common good. That's the idea.
I think the counterargument would be that universities are, you know, bastions for liberal points of view, and that if all the faculty are liberal or democratic or anti-Trump, whatever label you want to put on it, that that is going to get either filtered down or pushed to the students. And that's what you hear, is that a lot of faculty are more liberal, and that has a biased effect.
The current chair of the Faculty Senate, Matthew Wilsner, is that rare thing. He's a Republican professor, and he's done a great deal of research. In fact, his research touches on this. There's no doubt that faculties generally skew liberal. If you break up society into various categories like big business, small business, the military, the clergy, where are the liberals going to wind up? You know, in entertainment and the arts, for example. And no one complains, oh, Broadway, it's got too many liberals on it. Cranks do, but they're cranks. But what Matthew's research shows is it doesn't trickle down to students. By the time they're 18, 19, they're pretty set, and there's a sort of skew bias, but it goes both ways. So I think we need to separate those two claims. One, the faculties are generally liberal. True. Two, that this has a biased effect on the way they teach students. Not true.
A related question. In the classroom, there's a lot of debate around so-called trigger warnings and a professor letting students know, hey, the topics we're about to discuss could be upsetting. And you see this on the media, too. Sometimes in a news show, they'll say what you're about to hear might be upsetting to you. And I wondered how all of you come down on that. Is it good to encourage discussion that way, or is it just training young people to be too sensitive?
For me, I teach feminist media studies, critical cultural media studies, and every semester I have a number of students who come up to me and report to me that they have been victims of sexual assault, either at Penn State, often actually in that very same semester, or previous to coming to Penn State. So I'm very sensitive to this as an issue, and when we do talk about things like rape myths and how media promotes certain rape myths, I think it really respects my students who are often going through something in the moment to say what we're talking about at the beginning of class, if they need to take a minute and step outside and regain composure. And I also offer that out for any student at any time if we're ever talking about anything that's difficult, whether it's racism or sexism or issues of trans identity, and they ever feel that they need to step out, they're welcome to do that. And actually what it does is it opens up a space where students feel comfortable, they feel respected as individuals, and they feel as if there's an environment here at Penn State where they can share their opinions and their views and thoughts about what to do to make change.
I mean, in one way, you know, trigger warnings were all the rage like in 2015. It was part of the myth of the snowflake student, mm-hmm. the coddling of the American mind, that sort of thing. And I noticed a couple interesting things. One, students were much more likely to be derided as snowflakes if they were women who triggered by sexual assault. And some of the examples were actually quite strange, like students being triggered by Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart because they were triggered by colonialism. It seems a little bit strange. But when the triggered student was a male Iraq war vet triggered by PTSD, all of a sudden people took him more seriously. The AUP's only position on trigger warnings is they shouldn't be mandated by administration. Mm-hmm. This should be negotiated between professor and student. And if a professor wants to give students a heads up and say, look, this will be difficult, one part of the AUP statement is a little skeptical of that because they think it warps the whole educational enterprise around the supposedly triggering thing. At the same time, if students do approach, as they do Michelle, and say, look, this is going to be an issue for me, you negotiate it one-on-one. That's what pedagogy always does.
Right, because I could see that you could say, well, in a classroom, it's good to sometimes be taken aback, taken off guard. In life, you can't always be warned ahead of time.
Yeah, I've always, for at least 10 years now, I've always had something on my syllabus that says, we're going to be tackling issues that are difficult and controversial, and that means we need to respect one another in conversation, et cetera. So I've always had something like that on my syllabus. I tend to be fairly skeptical of trigger warnings, first because I think it invites me as professor to figure out what's going to be triggering to people, which I don't feel like I have any idea of because I don't know their perspective. I also think in terms of PTSD in particular, which is the context in which it's often sort of brought up, that kind of response can occur because of things that actually don't have anything to do with the actual content, right? It can be sounds, it can be colors, it can be many different things. So I feel like that's a health, you know,
issue.
It's an issue around people seeking the appropriate health care and not necessarily something that I can anticipate in the classroom. So my sort of view is that on the one hand, I don't feel kind of competent to figure out what the range is. And if I tried to do that, there would be a trigger warning between every single, you know, before every class, right, about something or another. But the other thing I will say is that I often have students come up to me afterwards, and I've had Iraq war vets do this when I've talked about 9/11 and the culture of war, or I've had students who talked about, you know, sexual assault or racism, you know, particular microaggressions, lots of different things. And I've never had them come to me and say to me, you should have warned me beforehand. Mm-hmm. What I have had is them saying to me, thank you for bringing this up. In this context, it's made me think about what's happened to me in a different way. It's made me angrier, or it's made me less angry, or whatever their response is. But they've never sort of said, you should have prepared me in some way to have this discussion. I think what my discussions in class have actually sort of produced for them is a way of thinking differently about their experiences that then prompts them in some cases to go seek mental help, but in other cases, you know, they want to talk to their parents about things they haven't felt comfortable talking about or go to a student group to kind of get involved. I've never had the situation where they said, you should have told me something different beforehand.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. We're talking about academic freedom with Penn State faculty members Michelle Rodino-Colacino, Michael Barrowbay, and Cynthia Young. Last year, Penn State and other universities said no to allowing white nationalist Richard Spencer speak on campus, and Penn State and other universities pointed to safety concerns. And Spencer said that universities were using those safety concerns as an excuse for silencing speech. What do you think?
What I would say is I think that the Richard Spencer speaking tour has been part of a larger kind of white nationalist strategy around both raising awareness of who he is and what he thinks and, you know, targeting particular campuses that they think will find a sympathetic audience. So I think there's a reason he asked to speak at Penn State and, you know, wouldn't ask to speak at New York University, for example, because he wouldn't have the same kind of thing come to him. So that's number one. So I'm skeptical of the kind of arguments around free speech because I think they're embedded within this context of trying to get out a particular message. I wouldn't want to be the president adjudicating this. That's what I would say, because given my opposition to just about everything Richard Spencer stands for, I wouldn't want him to speak. But having said that, I wouldn't be the person to say he can't speak. What I would do is make sure there was a very organized resistance to him speaking on campus so that there were people at the venue, that there were people organizing beforehand, that the kind of effort to say, here's what he's talking about, and this I don't consider to be part of a kind of reason, certainly not academic debate. I mean, there is a debate, I suppose, that he's engaging in. So all of those things would kind of color my ability to make a decision about it. So yeah, I'm glad I don't have to make the call.
Are universities obligated to give a platform for all speakers?
Absolutely not. My comeback was, you know, this is not a free speech issue. This is incitement to violence. It crosses a line that I think Milo Yiannopoulos has also crossed because he specifically targets students individually by name. He induces people to attack them. Spencer doesn't go quite that far, but I can tell you also that this is something that is not specific to Penn State. Every university president is in this position now, and that's why neither Cynthia nor I want to become university presidents. But the case law is pretty clear on this. Even though Spencer seems to have won his case, I think, against Michigan State, universities are not obliged under the First Amendment to give a platform for every single speaker. There are different degrees of public forums, like a designated public forum, a limited public forum. We could give him a slot to speak, and it could be midnight on a Sunday. Right? The only stipulation is that it has to be content neutral. The fact that neither Cynthia nor I nor Michelle likes a single thing that comes out of his mouth, including the words a and the, should not be the basis for the decision. It should be, you know, does this contribute to the educational mission of the university? Or in this case, does it distract from the educational mission? Because we've learned from Berkeley and Florida and places like that, that this is going to cost $500,000 and be a major disruption to almost no good purpose educationally.
I think one danger about the way Richard Spencer and speakers like him, one danger in framing his request to come here as a free speech issue is it's part of this larger move to weaponize free speech and make it appear as if speakers who actually work against freedom, against academic freedom, against the free and open exploration of truth, with the kind of hate that they promote, with even the violence that they promote and the targeting of students and the targeting of faculty that they promote. It's very ironic to me that they are using freedom of speech so successfully in their defense and turn it against the university and turn it against faculty who would oppose them.
Another question about speakers is there have been a couple of cases recently with students shouting down speakers and facing varying consequences depending on the university. Is shouting down another speaker, is that free speech or is that squelching discussion debate?
That's the heckler's veto is what that is.
The heckler's veto.
You know, I hate to say it, but if Charles Murray comes to speak, people should listen to him and then they should take him apart in the questions. He's a hack, but he is not actually an incitement to violence hack. I mean, there's a line I draw between obnoxious intellectuals and pseudo-intellectuals. Ben Shapiro's on that list as well. Christina Hoff Sommers, Ann Coulter, that whole, you know, hideous crew. But they're not going to come with torches. Spencer comes, there are going to be people with torches. By the way, a little known thing, UVA had an open flame policy that they did not enforce on that campus. I looked it up here. We have one, too. No open flames on campus. I did not get a PhD to find that out, but now I know it.
Do you agree with that approach to having speakers?
Yes. I don't think that any of us got into the business of doing research and giving talks so that we could go someplace that we were invited, presumably, and get shouted down by people. So I certainly have sympathy for that position. I would say, however, that people like Charles Murray masquerade as academics, though I don't think they are, because I don't think they actually adhere to any rigorous standards of research and scholarship. And then they use that power and privilege to say things that are incredibly racist, but also hurtful to people in the audience. So while that wouldn't be my tactic, going to something to kind of shout people down, I do understand the fact that when people go and they hear themselves being compared to monkeys who grow up in a jungle, that they don't react by just saying, oh, that's very interesting. He just said that about me, right? They get angry and impassioned. And I think that that's something that sometimes we want to put in a framework that's kind of a rational framework, but actually they're responding in a way that is kind of emotional and visceral, just as anyone would if they felt that their like very character was being impugned. So again, I don't know about all the specifics, but I do think that I can understand how you would be at that and hear something that felt like it was an insult to, you know, your very being and respond by yelling.
Another issue that comes up in the age of social media is how much freedom a person, in this case faculty, should have expressing themselves outside of the jobs. And there was a recent issue in the news where the professor lost his job after suggesting in a tweet that Hurricane Harvey was karma for Texans.
Wow.
And right, I think everyone can agree that that is offensive and poorly thought out. But is it okay to get fired for a tweet?
Talk about things that are shifting under our feet as we speak at the AAUP. There is a policy on electronic communication and social media. There is policy on extramural speech, but it's very murky. If you go back to what I was saying earlier about academic freedom is tied to expertise, now we're in terrains where maybe you're not speaking in your area of expertise. You're just mouthing off like any other citizen. On the one hand, you can. No one suspended their First Amendment rights when they took a job at Penn State or any other university. On the other hand, if you're just mouthing off, especially on Twitter, which is like a human zoo anyway, you can expect to get some pushback. And you might even expect, if a tweet really crosses the line, you think of the Stephen Salaita case at the University of Illinois. He was hired by Illinois away from Virginia Tech. He moved his family. He had been assigned courses for the fall. And that was the summer of 2014. Israel's incursion into Gaza really angered a lot of people. And he himself is Palestinian American. These were his people. And he tweeted off a bunch of fiery things that eventually got him dehired. It was an unprecedented case, and it led to AAUP of University of Illinois. But you're in very murky waters where someone is speaking just off the cuff, not in their area of expertise. They should, first of all, make sure they're not speaking for the institution. And here's where the AAUP gets even murkier. Yeah. They should show respect for the opinions of others. They should remember that they have a special position in the community. And it implies that they should be held to a higher standard of extramural discourse, even on Twitter. And that's where that's really where the rubber meets the road, right there.
Do you think faculty academics should be held to a higher standard, Michelle?
I do, actually. I mean, this is our job. I mean, I do think that we should think before we speak. When we're speaking on behalf of Penn State or when we're representing our research or in the classroom, of course, we have to keep the highest standards of credibility and speaking with evidence to support our claims. That's what we do. That's what we're paid to do. I think extramurally, it depends because there are situations where we might be speaking not as Penn State employees, and actually AUP also in that kind of murky policy on social media was good enough to say, at the same time, it's going to be difficult for faculty to always distance themselves from their job.
Right.
And you can't always say when you're posting something on Facebook, by the way, this doesn't represent the opinions of the Penn State University. There has to be some understanding that I exist as Michelle Rodino-Colacino apart from Associate Professor of Communications and Women's Studies at Penn State. But on the other hand, social media also has a tendency to bleed our personas and our work. So I think with that in mind, we kind of have to do the best that we can, but I don't think that this is something that should be a career-ending scenario. Kind of going back to the history of AUP, actually, and people might be surprised to know that one of the early cases of a Stanford University professor getting fired actually made comments that were anti-immigrant and also anti-railroad, but were against the interests of the Stanford family. That's another thing that we care about when we guarantee, you know, we try to ensure academic freedom, is that we're not being put in a situation where we would be criticized for criticizing our own university, or penalized, I should say, for criticizing our own right. university.
Does a shift toward having more adjunct instructors at universities, not just Penn State, away from tenure track faculty, does that threaten free discussion at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. It erodes the entire enterprise.
I mean, one thing I would say, though, about this issue is that of the cases of people being targeted for harassment as professors, 48% of them, according to the AAUP report, were because they were talking about race. I think this issue around what people are saying on social media has had a completely kind of racialized character. Mm-hmm. In other words, when people say things about Trump being a white supremacist, or when they say things mm-hmm. about Islamophobia, they tend to be targets in a way that if they're talking about some other issue that people find controversial, you know, like fracking, they right. aren't. So I think that that's something to sort of take into account. Mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty slippery slope, and I don't really know exactly where I come down. I know that I am very careful on social media about the things that I say, because I know that anything you say can be taken out of context. And people will take little snippets right. of whatever you say and then frame it in a way that you perhaps didn't intend it. And I think a lot of scholars of color that I know do that as well, because we know that we're under heightened scrutiny, and we know that there is a orchestrated campaign, you know, with political watch lists and all the rest of it, that are particularly looking mm-hmm. at people in our fields.
Mm-hmm. Here's one final wrinkle, though, that many people don't understand, especially for professors. It's the Pickering versus Board of Ed case from 1968. So Pickering was this guy in Illinois, just happens to be Illinois, who was the local crank. And he was always accusing the Board of Ed of all this sort of malfeasance. And he was wrong. And they sued him for defamation. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court held that Pickering was protected under the First Amendment because no one could possibly take him seriously. You apply that to professors, and it means that a guy who teaches metallurgy, who denies the Holocaust, has more protection than a historian who denies the Holocaust. The closer you get to your area of expertise, the more your utterances outside the classroom would be taken as evidence of what you do inside the classroom. Whereas if I just mouth off about fracking, I'm a professor of English. What do I know about fracking? I'm just really skeptical of it. Then I have the same sort of protection as any other citizen. So there's a really strange wrinkle here for professors, where they have more First Amendment protection when they speak outside their area of expertise than when they speak within.
And one last question. We'll put this one to Michelle. We've talked about it a little bit, but specifically AAUP has an initiative right now, One Faculty, One Resistance. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So the AUP at the national level has realized that we have to do something, and that we actually can do something, so that they've launched a campaign asking college campuses and faculty across campuses, both as individuals and as campus chapters, to come together to mobilize and basically to defend each other's academic freedom and to defend academics who are being targeted. There are so many resources that will both raise awareness and give pointers as what you can do to mobilize, what you can do to defend specific individual faculty who may be targets at your campus. And there's even financial support at the national level. If you are a target of harassment for what you research, for what you teach, or what you say outside of the classroom, you can actually apply for a grant for your legal defense.
Yeah. Just to, again, play the devil's advocate, I can hear someone saying, well, here are the faculty member coming together and putting up this group support, getting financial backing for it, when they're just fighting against people who are just trying to express their own opinions and have free speech by identifying faculty who are promoting their own views.
If that were true, there would not be a need to mobilize collectively, but that is not what's happening. What's happening right now is, in half of all these cases of reported harassment to the AUP, half of these faculty are being threatened with physical violence. They're being threatened bodily harm. They're being threatened. Their families are being threatened. And so this has gone beyond just a case of one point of view against another point of view. And this has a widespread chilling effect. So this work that's happening to come together to mobilize is really in support of academic freedom, and ultimately is in the spirit of freedom of speech, where everyone should have a chance to express their opinion, and faculty who are experts in their area should, in fact, be able to go forward in their pursuit of the truth for the common good.
Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Penn State faculty members Michelle Rodino-Colacino, Michael Barovay, and Cynthia Young. To hear this and other Take Note interviews, go to wpsu.org/take note. I'm Ann Danahy, WPSU.